home and tell Catherine how many people from how many parts of the earth came to hear me. Wow, it's great to be here. Thank you, all of you locals, for being here. And thanks for Mom and Dad and Mary Beth and Jolene and Ted and Luann and Joe Marshall's. Wow, this is just a delight. I'm doubly honored. I'm humbled. And those of you that are here for the first time, first of all, if you are here and do not have one of the study guides, I thought I brought one with me, but we have extras, and we want you to follow along with us. So if you would hold up your hand, one of our good brothers, if you would like to follow along with the two lessons tonight, we'll be sure that you have one. Hold them up until somebody gets by you. They're coming. And you can follow along with us. I know they're here somewhere because I saw a stack of them. If you are here for the first time, though, let me just say this. This very first lesson that we're going to do is kind of an overview. It's like a nuts and bolts capsulization of everything that we've said so far. You know what? Keep looking or keep holding your hands up. And would you, these are the ones for just tonight. And if they don't find those here, they come maybe. Keep your hand held up and we'll get you one of those one way or the other. The lesson, for those of you that already have the workbooks, the lesson tonight is called Renewing an Evangelistic Spirit and Steps to Sharing the New Life. So we're going to start off by just capsulizing everything that we've tried to share this weekend. If you want to be a fisher of men, if you want to be like Jesus was with Zacchaeus, here are about 8 simple steps that are mandatory. And this will be a review for those of you that have been here all along, but kind of for those of you who haven't, just an overview of where we've come from the beginning. I want us to start again with just one more word of prayer, and I want you, I'm going to pause in the middle of the prayer. I want you to be praying silently in your own heart, in your own mind, about 1 or 2 or 3 lost people that you know that you will personally commit to reach out to in the coming 7 days. I don't know what their names are. You don't need to share their names. These are between you and God. And I'm just going to ask that you mention those people in your prayer silently, and that you ask God to open their hearts and to give you the courage to say what needs to be said. Let's pray. Holy God, I'm humbled and thankful for the opportunity to be here tonight. You are a great God. You are a powerful God. And we'll just go ahead and confess to you that sometimes in the busyness, in the rush of life, we are not as forthcoming as we ought to be with the gospel. We just miss countless opportunities. We have neighbors, we have coworkers, we have friends, and maybe even relatives that have never come to know Jesus Christ. They are still outside that ark of safety. And right now, we're just going to pause for a few moments, and each of us is going to think of people that we know that we want you to give us opportunity to reach out to in the coming 7 days. So hear our prayers as we lift those names before you even now. God, I want to pray for some people at our congregation that have been attending. I want to pray for Nick and Nicholas, going through some really tough times and are confused by life and overwhelmed by life. Would you use me, use others of our brothers and sisters to reach out to them? I'm praying for John Manzi. Father, I'm also praying for John Grillo, our secretary's husband, who has just been exposed to you over and over and over again by a loving and devoted wife, by a church full of people who care about him, but his heart has still not softened towards you. And I just lift him up again to you in our prayer, in this prayer. Again, I pray that you'll speak with me, through me, during the first and the second sessions tonight. And I pray that somehow something will happen in our hearts that will move us away from what is so often lethargy and carelessness, and move us to a greater fervor, a greater commitment. Help the gospel of Jesus to be a fire within our bones that just burns and spreads. It's in the name of Jesus that we offer this prayer. Amen. Okay, you got your blanks ready to go and your pencils ready to go, and we're going to kind of jump around a little bit during this first session. Number one, I want to suggest to you, if we are going to be evangelistic in our outreach, we must be motivated. And what your elders and Joe and the others that are working with the church here said, you know, this Dan Cooper, he's supposed to be able to motivate people to be more evangelistic. We shared Sunday morning that most of us raised our hands when we got to that question, how did you come to the Lord? How did you come to be a part of this church? Most of us raised our hands when we got to the influence of a friend or a relative. And if that's what was effective in reaching out to us, guess what? That's what's going to be most effective in reaching out to most of your friends. It's not an expensive advertising blitz on the radio or TV. It's not building a bigger, newer building in some very obvious spot in town. The most likely way is for you, individual Christians, people in the pew, to share their faith with their friends and relatives. And I believe very candidly that Matthew 7 or Matthew 9 verse 37 is still true today. We may not always understand that passage that was read in our hearing just a few moments ago. I believe that the harvest is still plentiful, but the workers are few. Another one of those kids' songs, I'm in the Lord's army, I'm in the Lord's army, I may never march in the infantry, fly o'er the enemy, or shoot the artillery. I don't sing it real often. And that wasn't in my notes, by the way. But guess what? We are all in that army. We're in the Lord's army. It was a position we volunteered for when we became a Christian. So number one, we must be motivated. The harvest is plentiful today, and the laborers are still few today. Number two, we must have a friend. Now all the tax gatherers and sinners were coming to him to listen to him, and both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble. Did you notice how much grumbling goes on in the New Testament? Saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And several of you said to me after those Sunday presentations, like, okay, the idea that it's okay to have non-Christian friends, that's kind of a novel idea. I thought all of my friends were supposed to be Christians. And that's good for having Christian friends. I'm glad I've got a lot of Christian friends, but it's also okay to have non-Christian friends. That's what Jesus did. Matter of fact, if you remember the story of Jesus, can I just go ahead and tell you? The religious folk didn't particularly like him. He didn't get along real well with the establishment, with the religious establishment. You know who Jesus liked and who reached towards him? It was the very people that needed to learn about Jesus. It was the sinners and the publicans. It was those that were the cast-offs of the earth, that were the ones that weren't particularly popular and didn't seem religious. And so my challenge is to us, we must have a friend. More specifically, I want to put in parentheses, a non-Christian friend. Number three, we must have a message. Paul says, third missionary journey, I did not shrink from declaring the whole counsel of God. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. We're supposed to study to show ourselves approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, handling correctly the word of truth. Yes, we need to know the word. We're supposed to study or to be diligent. And then Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3 says we're always to be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks about the hope that we have within us. But as we do that, and I notice, and I think this is so important, so please hear me here in this. It's not that we debate our way into rightness. It's not that we argue our way into rightness. But when we give that ready answer, did you notice the last two words in that last phrase of how we do that? He says we do it, my New American Standard Translation says, we do that with gentleness and reverence. And so often, those of us in the churches of Christ, can I just tell you historically, we have not been known for our gentleness and reverence about the way we answered people's religious questions. We were perceived as being arrogant, cocky, and know-it-all. And that's sad to me, because that's not the attitude that we're supposed to have, Peter says. He says, yes, give your answer, but when you do it, you're very deliberate about the way you do it. You do it with gentleness and reverence. Who has another translation there in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15? Give us another word or two. I have had it, but I don't have those right notes to me right now. Gentleness and reverence. What's another translation there for chapter 3 and verse 15? with meekness and fear. There you go. Yeah. No, I'm not the bold, crass one that's coming across condemning you to hell. But we do that with great meekness and with fear, like looking to our own selves, lest we be judged. That's good. And those of you who have different translations, stick another word in there. But we must have a message. I'm not talking about communicating some social gospel. Hey, come and join our church. We have good meals together. We do some neat things with the teenagers. Those things may all be true, but we have a message that the world needs to hear. And the bottom line is, it's the message that Jesus Christ cares about lost people. He established the church, and the church is God's vehicle through which people can come to know who Jesus is. Number four, maybe one of the big differences in some of the more traditional, old-fashioned methods of outreach, we don't necessarily begin with the Bible in our hand, wanting to hit somebody over the head with the Bible that says, you better believe this or else. We start, as we proclaim the message, by addressing our non-Christians' friends' felt needs. I guess I'm saying it this way. We don't start with people where we are. We start with people where they are. And they may be having financial difficulties. They may be down on life or down on their luck. They may be going through some kind of a major crisis in their life, and they're looking up to God saying, I don't know what to do now. And so maybe the first thing that you do with them isn't set up a Bible study to say, hey, I want to tell you how you want to become a Christian. Maybe the way you start with them is just by listening. It's just by being a friend. And so we start with felt needs. Now, that's not where we're going to end up, but that's where we're going to start. And sometimes it'll take a week. Sometimes it'll take a month. Sometimes it'll take a year before we've built enough credibility with these non-Christian people that we really have the right to enter into that sacred territory of, is your relationship with God right? So we begin with felt needs. Number five, as we go, we build credibility for the word. Jesus says, let your light so shine before men in such a way that they will see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And we've talked about this earlier. What happens when somebody knocks on your doors and says, I'd like to come in and study the Bible with you? I'll tell you what I do. The defenses go up. I don't know you. You're probably some religious kook. I don't know anything about you. I don't want to really hear what you have to say. And so what happens with friendship evangelism is, because of our friendship, because of our rapport, because of our relationship, they get to know something of who we are and what kind of people we are. We build credibility for the word before we jump into a big-time serious discussion about whether or not they're going to heaven or hell. We're not avoiding that. We're not steering clear of that. We need to get there. And if the relationship never gets there, there's something wrong with us, because we're going to be like Jesus. And Jesus, Luke 19:10, came to seek and to save the lost. So we're going to get there, but we may not get there as quickly as we used to when we knocked on doors and said, hello, my name is, can I come and study the Bible with you? Like, that scares me, just very honestly. Maybe it's my New Jersey roots these days, but I get skeptical of people, strangers coming to my door and trying to promote something to me. That's number five. Number six. We kind of hinted on this already. We must confront our friends with the gospel. Let me give you one word of warning here. All that I've just said may sound like I'm leaning one direction, and what I'm about to say may sound like, Dan, you're doing double talk. And I don't want that to be the case. I want to clarify. I want to give some parameters here. We must confront the friend with the gospel. It may take a week, it may take a month, it may even take several months. But we've got to get to the confrontation. We've got to get to the message that Jesus gave in John chapter 8 and verse 24. I said therefore unto you that you shall die in your sins, for unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. That's the negative way to say John 3:16. John 3:16 is, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Jesus in John 8:24 says, if you don't believe, you're going to die in your sins. And so we confront the friend with the gospel. Now here's the word of caution. When you make a new friend, the longer it takes to get to the story of Jesus, the harder it is to finally get there. Let me say it again. I'm saying you need to give some time for a relationship to grow and to develop and for credibility to exist. But then I'm also saying the longer that it takes to get to the discussion about Jesus and about eternity, the harder it is to finally get there. So say you've had a coworker that you've known for 15 years and you've worked side by side with him or her, and you've never talked to Jesus or to them about Jesus. You've never talked to them about church. And you bring up the subject finally after 15 years and you say, you know, I really want to have a religious discussion with you. I want to talk to you about Jesus, to you about church. There's something that's very important to me. And they look at you and say, 15 years you've known me and you're just now getting to it? How important is that really? Are you with me? Shake your head yes or no. And so you don't wait too long, but you eventually get to the point when you've established that credibility that you confront the friend with the gospel. Okay, trying to decide what to leave out. Number seven. We've confronted the friend with the gospel, or we get in the situation so that we're ready to confront the friend with the gospel. Another significant dynamic in this whole process, the way that I'm picturing it, is we have led this non-Christian friend into friendship with our other Christian friends. So in other words, we're not doing the solo effort, seeing how many notches we can get on our belts doing this solo evangelism. Rather, what we're doing is we are leavening people into relationship, whether it's in the church building or before they ever get to the church building, and they're getting to know some of our other Christian friends so that the first time they do come here, they already know some folks and they don't feel like total strangers. And so this business of friendship evangelism says, guess what? It's not one or two people on the mission team or on the evangelism team. It's a whole church full of people that are being sensitive, that have the radar out, that have the antenna out, and they're beeping, looking for a signal to come back of, hey, here's somebody that may be interested in spiritual things. And so we've led our non-Christian friend to be a friend, or to at least get to know our Christian friends, so that when they do come into the church building, they already have relationships, or at least they know some people, even if they don't have relationships. And that's one of the very basic premises upon which friendship evangelism works. It's a team effort, and all of us are working in this process together, because guess what? All Christian people, by nature, are in the business of seeking and saving the lost. So we're all working on this together. And finally, number eight, the cycle is completed when our new friend, who has now become a Christian, is a Christian, they begin to grow, and so we equip this new Christian to share Jesus with others that are not yet Christians. And so Jesus says in the sermon or in the Great Commission, the things that you have heard from, or he says in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, the things that you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these commit to faithful men who will be able to teach other men as well. And he says in the Great Commission, once a person has been taught, and once they've been baptized, then you teach them some more, so that they will mature and so that they will grow. And so we must equip the new Christians to share Jesus with his or her other friends. And those of you that are here for the first time, and those of you that have heard this before, let me just say it again. Study after study of church growth says that most people who ever lead another person to Jesus Christ and lead that person to accept Jesus, to be immersed into Christ, do so the first 2 years that they're a Christian. And that the longer a person has been a Christian, the less likely that it is that they will be effective in evangelism. And I'm saying there's something skewed there. There's something horribly wrong there. But that's what church growth studies reveal. And so if you've been a Christian 20, 30, 40 years, you may know more than a bunch of baby Christians. But the likelihood is that the baby Christian will be effective in sharing their faith before you are. And you know what? I just go on record as saying I'd like to see that changed. That's horrible. You know, those of us that have been in the church, members of the church for 20, 30, 40 years, we ought to be the most confident, the most sensitive, and the most capable when it comes to sharing faith. But the reality of it is, when we lose the fervor and the zeal and the enthusiasm of discovering what it's like to be a Christian, frequently, hand in hand with that, goes a loss of our evangelistic fervor, and we become what I call root bound. Any of you people who are gardeners, you know a pot will only hold a plant that is so big and then the roots turn inward and they won't grow anymore. That's the way it is with a lot of Christians. They're root bound. All of their relationships are in the church. They don't have non-Christian friends, and so they don't grow. And the people that they need to be sharing the gospel with don't grow. So there you go, steps to sharing the new life. We must be motivated, and I hope that's what this whole seminar has been all about. We must have a friend, specifically a non-Christian friend, and we need to be praying about that friend. We need to target that friend. We must have a message. So yeah, we do need to know what the Word says, and that's very important. But as we give the message, we do that with gentleness and reverence. We begin with felt needs, and we build credibility for the Word through our relationship with them. We do get to the confrontation with the gospel, and that must never be sidestepped or avoided. We confront the friend with the gospel. In the process of our relationship with them, we've led this person to be a friend of our other friends. Let me tell you the truth. I've been in ministry for 35 years. In my 35 years of ministry, I have met one person, one, who was converted by somebody that he didn't like. People aren't going to respond to you or to the message that you are carrying if they don't like you. It's a rare bird indeed who will hear the message and not like the messenger. A rare bird. I've had it happen one time. It was up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And this guy, you know those hard heads in eastern Pennsylvania, he just said, I did not like the man. He was crude. This is the Christian. The man that was converted was talking about the Christian. I did not like him. He was mean. He was argumentative. He was arrogant. I did not like at all who he was or the way he conducted the studies with me. But you know what? He was teaching the truth, and I could not deny it was true, and I became a Christian in spite of it. That's a rare person. That's a very rare person. So we've led our new friend to be a Christian, to be a friend of our other Christians. And see, there's two things that are necessary for a person to become a Christian, I believe, and to be a healthy part of the body. Number one, they need to understand the message. What does the Bible say about salvation? How are you saved? But number two, they need to have relationship. And that's what all the one another passages were about yesterday. You know, we have fellowship with one another. We build up one another. We encourage each other. And finally, number eight, we must equip this new Christian to duplicate the cycle, to share Jesus with his other family members or his other friends. Okay, lesson one, we did it on time. Bravo. Somebody clap, say, yay, did it again. Good, no. And we're going to sing a song, we're going to stand up, and then we're going to go into session number two for the night. Okay? Who's going to, you're going to lead us? Bryce, come. Did Jewel Miller film strips with my parents. I was a little tot, first, second, third grade. And Mom and Dad taught Bible studies, Jewel Miller, frequently, usually. And one, two, sometimes even three nights a week. But you know what? Jewel Miller's approach, even then, wasn't perfect. Before he died, I talked to Jewel about some of the problems that I saw with his film strip. First of all, commended him. Excellent, excellent teaching tool. Many of us were converted using that tool. Many of you were converted using that tool, I suspect. But it's not perfect. I've used some of Ivan Stewart's stuff. I've used some of Owen Albright's stuff. The OBS method. You know, you name the method, and if you give me enough time with it, I will say, here's a potential problem. And the same is true with friendship evangelism. And I just want to be real candid with you during these last few minutes and say, here are some of the problems that I want to prepare you for individually if you are serious about becoming more focused on evangelism. So that's where we're going. I'm going to have 5 points I'm going to share with you. But before I get there, I just want to say something personal to you about my experience with you. I do these seminars 4 times a year somewhere in the country or in the world. And I just have to tell you that you as a church are doing so, so, so many things right. I've appreciated getting to know a number of your elders. Spent the better part of the day with Joe and Dwight and Bryce today. And you've got some quality, capable, loving, dedicated ministers that are working on your staff. And I hope you love on them and appreciate them. Pay them more. We're worth more than we get paid. They didn't tell me to say that. But you are blessed. Your church has talked about in many parts of our brotherhood. You are a model in many, many ways. I'm serious about that. You are a model for the way church could be and should be done. I know you don't get it all right all the time. And I always say, if you find a perfect church, never join it because you'll ruin it. You know, there are no perfect churches. You aren't a perfect church, but you're doing a lot of things right. And I just want to say, praise be to God. And if John were writing up churches today, I think he'd have a lot of wonderful things. You may be one of those churches that John would say nothing negative about. I don't know. Although I hear he's writing a letter to you guys. I'm not sure. Is that right? There's a letter coming to this church? Maybe one of these days, anyway. So, thank you. You've been good to me. You've encouraged me. I've enjoyed being with you. You're great cooks, too. Man, I'm telling you, we've had some great meals all along. Okay, you ready for this last session? We can do it in 20 minutes, and I'll be a promise keeper and finish up, and we'll be done on time. Number one, what if you decide, okay, Dan, we're going to be evangelistic. Friendship evangelism requires significant investments of time. It is time-consuming to invest your life in the life of another person. Because this person isn't a prospect. They're not a contact that you go visit for 1 hour a week for a Tuesday night or a Thursday night or a Monday night Bible study. They are a friend. And my friends, guess what? My friends are like my children. Did you ever notice how children don't call on you when it's convenient all the time? Sometimes you're in the middle of something else and kids fall and hurt themselves. Sometimes you're in the middle of something else and somebody will call, one of the kids will call and say, look, I need some help, or this just happened. And that's the way non-Christians are that we're trying to reach out to. We are their friends and we treat them like a friend, not like a business contact that we're trying to sell something to. I like this article. I am going to take the time to read it because I think it emphasizes a point that needs to be emphasized. This is called The Day of the Cheap Conversion is Over. Time was that a church could generate a number of cheap conversions through techniques that you would recognize. Spread a few tracts around, invite a powerful evangelist in for a week-long gospel meeting, set up a series of one-hour Bible studies with prospects, and reap a harvest of souls at the end of the week with a flurry of passion and excitement. We really thought it was a legitimate way to evangelize. Nobody meant to be doing anything other than the will of God. Yet most people knew intuitively that something wasn't quite right, because the only ones that remained faithful within 3 or 4 months of the great revival were the children and the mates of those who were already members of the local church. So we learned something. We learned that most genuine conversions require time and patience. We found out that 1 week of intense involvement with someone could not sustain him or her for the remaining 51 weeks of the year. We discovered that something had to be done to integrate new converts into the existing body of believers. What we really learned is that evangelism is harder work than most of us really want to do. A week or two for soul winning is a cop-out. Soul winning has to occur in the context of a lifestyle which communicates the meaning of Christ to people. We talked earlier about building rapport. That's what we're talking about. This person says, I used to marvel at the two-week wonders who could go out of the state or out of the country for a couple of weeks and come back with tales of evangelistic zeal, and 6 or 8 or 12 converted by them, and a contented look of achievement on their faces. Yet those same people could not convert one person in their own hometown. Then it all became clear. It is easy to be evangelistic for a week in a place where nobody knows you. You can pray as if it were normal. You can talk of Jesus with whomever you meet, as if you were accustomed to doing that. And most of all, you could let people tug on you and impose on you because you knew you were headed for home in only a few days. Those were, for the most part, cheap conversions. And their day has passed. Thank God. Listen to these last couple of sentences. From now on, more of us are going to have to realize that we can evangelize only in the context of involvement with people. We will have to know people, not just bombard them with an hour-long sales pitch for Jesus. We will have to care about people, bear some of their burdens, rebuke their sins, and confess our own. This new way of evangelism is really the oldest way. You see, it was Jesus' method among men, and we must learn to do His work by His means. Is that powerful? Wow. Why don't we do friendship evangelism? Because it drains us. It's time consuming. By the way, I have no idea what you think of Reubel Shelley, but he was the one that penned those words about 20 years ago. Powerful. Right on target. And you know what? Even once they become Christians, and we talked about this earlier, baby Christians still take time. I'll never forget one of the couples we baptized the middle of last May. Myself and a group of 33 of us were headed off for a France mission trip. We were leaving on Friday. This couple, Charles and Dorothy, in their late 60s or early 70s, had just been baptized. I'd studied with them for several months. They'd been to one of our life groups since the previous September. And the night that they were baptized, they were both in the pool together, in the baptismal pool together. Dorothy, the wife, looked up to me and said, "Now that we're baptized, are you still going to keep coming to study with us?" Significant investments of time. And the answer is yes. I've been there every week with, I think, two exceptions over the last 3 months, 4 months since they were baptized. Friendship evangelism is demanding. It's time consuming. Number two peril of friendship evangelism is you open yourself up to hurt. Can I be very, very honest with you? And I'll just tell you right up front, the people that have hurt me most deeply in this life were not alien sinners. They were other Christians. How about you? Don't answer out loud. Don't call their name. But you know who has the ability to hurt us the most? The ones that we love the most. Who do you love the most? Other Christians. Let me go a step beyond that. You want me to show you two people that can really hurt each other? Let me show you a husband and wife that are feuding and fighting and about to divorce. I will show you two people who can really, really hurt each other. And so when you become a friend to a non-Christian, and they become a Christian, or even if they don't become a Christian, you open yourself up to hurt because you've befriended them, you've loved them, you've invested your time and your energy in them. And once you do that, they're not a prospect, they're not a contact that you're trying to sell something to. They are your friends, for sure. And they can hurt you very deeply. I could tell you about Joe and Connie. I'm going to tell you about Joe and Connie. Knocking on doors was not my favorite thing, but I did a lot of it in my younger years. And one door that we knocked on in a big apartment complex, we could do that in those days, even in New Jersey. The young couple opened the door, said, "My name is Dan, this is my wife Catherine. We're going door to door inviting people to some Bible studies and inviting people to some special meetings. And we also like to just study the Bible with people. Could we come back sometime later this week or next to have a Bible study?" They said, "Come in right now." I about dropped my teeth, and I didn't even have false teeth. I thought, wow, this is cool. So we went in, started studying the Bible, studied with them about 45 minutes, maybe even an hour, and said, "Look, you know, the meetings that are going on, they start next Sunday, and we'd like to invite you, but could we come back maybe next week and study some more?" And they said, "You can come back later this week if you want." So I thought, wow, is this a dream or is this real? And we came back the next week, and then they started asking these kind of what I call off-the-wall questions that just didn't quite fit. Like, "Do you believe that Jesus really is God's son? And do you know anything about only 144,000 people being saved?" You know, those kind of questions. And if you've done many Bible studies, you know. What happened with Joe and Connie is that the Jehovah's Witnesses, the JWs, I call them jaywalkers, they had gotten to them about 2 weeks before we did. And so the JWs would study with them one time, and they'd have them convinced that they were right, and then we'd go back, and the next time, we'd study with them, and they'd be convinced we were right. So we went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and finally the inevitable happened. You know what the inevitable is. The inevitable is Joe and Connie were thoroughly confused, and they said, "Dan, when you're here with us, when you and Catherine are here, we believe you, and we understand your understanding of Scripture. But when they're here, their understanding of Scripture makes sense. Would you come back sometime when they're here, and you guys duke it out?" They didn't say that, but that's what we did, okay? "We just want to decide, you know, and we want to have you both here together. By the way, talk to me." We did agree, and it did work out okay. But there need to be some ground rules. And if you're ever in that situation, I'd like to give you about 3 suggestions. So if you're ever in that situation or think you might be, talk to me afterwards and I'll give you some guidelines that you need to observe and that you need to respect if you're ever in a study with Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons or other kind of people like that, some guidelines that we found to be very, very helpful. Joe and Connie, eventually, first one, then the other, were converted and became involved in our teaching program. They taught preschool children. And so the truth ultimately won. But then Joe and Connie started having marital issues. And you know how so often that goes. They first missed a week or two, and then another 2 or 3 weeks over a period of about 3 years, 2 years, we totally lost them. But because I loved Joe and Connie, because we had invested so much of our time and energy, it wasn't just, oh, that's so sad, we lost two more church members. It was like, no, I loved you guys. We spent lots of time together. And so it hurts. And if you're going to invest in people's lives, they don't always do it the right way. Amen? One of the things I love about woodworking, I know one or two or maybe more of your brothers are woodworkers, maybe sisters are too, but most I've talked to brothers. And one of the things I love about woodwork is if I do everything right, when I'm done with that piece, whether it's refinishing a piece or building a piece from scratch, it's going to look good and it's going to be good. But ask some of the preachers, or maybe you've been there yourself, even when we do everything right with people, guess what? They still have this thing called free will. And they can still go their way and mess up. And so you're going to get hurt if you're going to be involved in evangelism because people don't always do the right thing. Number three, your friendship becomes an end in and of itself. We have a world full of hurting, lonely people that are just looking for a friend. And guess what? We Christians ought to be some of the best friends there are anywhere. We're going to be honest. We're going to be straightforward. We're going to listen. They can trust us with a confidence. We are the kind of friends that the world is looking for if we're the kind of Christian we ought to be. And so the story is about a guy by the name of Horace. Horace Moody, I met on a door-knocking campaign in Princeton, New Jersey. He was a retired fundraiser for Princeton. He had made lots of money, raised millions of dollars for Princeton University. But here he is now, as we're knocking on doors, he is a lonely old man with no wife, no children, no family whatsoever. We knock on his door, tell him what we're there for. He says, come on in, I'd like to hear more. So we came in, studied with him. After that campaign was over, I wrote him letters back, and it was cool. He continued to have an interest in church, in spiritual things. We continued to study the Bible through phone calls and through letters, and he started going to the church in Princeton. This is in the mid and early 1970s. I was a junior at Harding that year, and he called me along about January or February and said, Dan, I'd like for you to fly up to see me. I said, Horace, respectfully, you don't understand. I'm a full-time college student, and I don't have any money. I can't just fly up to see you. He said, look, you're my friend. I will pay for your way. You jump on a plane to Little Rock. You can fly into Newark. I'll rent you a car, and we'll do dinner together. We'll study the Bible. We'll go to church together. What would you say? Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. Get a break from college and go see Horace and get to rent a car. I'd never rented a car at that time. We studied the Bible several times. Good student. But what I discovered about Horace as time went on, by the way, he was in contact with the church again, the local church there. Horace was never converted. I got a phone call the next year saying Horace had died. His funeral was conducted at the Princeton church by Princeton ministerial staff, but he never became a Christian. And what I discovered in retrospect was that Horace just needed a friend. He never, I don't think, really was interested. Maybe he was, but he never seemed to move much. He was doing the things that he thought it would take to maintain friendship. And there are people like that. There are just people like that. All they want is a friend. They don't want Jesus. They don't want spirituality. All they want is somebody to be their friend. My brother John, I had about half my family here, but I do have one other brother that you haven't met. And my brother John says, well, Dan, that just goes... The guy's name was Horace, H-O-R-A-C-E, Moody. That just goes to prove that old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't baptize him. And so the bottom line is, what had happened was the friendship had become an end in and of itself. He just wanted a friend. And if you're going to practice evangelism, there are some people out there who all they want is a friend. They really don't care what makes you what you are. They don't have an interest in spiritual things. And that's when it comes to shaking the dust off your feet and moving on. That's when it comes to a lot of prayers for wisdom. And that's when it may come to putting some people on the back burner while you move other people up to the front burner. And you ladies who are cooks will know what I mean by that. Your friendship becomes an end in and of itself. Number four, your friends can become overly dependent upon you. That's another peril, another pitfall. There are those people out there who, yes, they are your friend, and yes, they will be baptized. Yes, they will put on faith and become Christians. And at first, an overly dependent friend, can I just tell you, it's very flattering. It feels good, like, wow, they really want to be my friend. One family that I'm thinking of, I won't give their names, but they had been converted during a campaign, and Catherine and I were busy following up on some others, trying to teach and study them, and we noticed that this one couple kind of was floundering. They weren't coming regularly, so Catherine and I looked to each other and said, you know what, rather than reaching out to some people that hadn't even been converted, let's reach out to this couple and spend some extra time with them. So we told them, look, you know, we've only got 7 nights a week, and we're going to do Bible studies 2 or 3 nights a week. And how about if, rather than us going out and visiting with some other people that aren't Christians yet, we spend time with you. We'll come to your house 1 week, we'll do dinner together, we'll do a Bible study together, and then the next week, you come to our house, and we'll do dinner together, and we'll do a Bible study together. We're going to do that for the next 3 months. Everybody says, cool, isn't that a great way? You know, we get into their home, they get into our home, we do Bible studies. This is back when we were working on poverty level wages at the first church, and a car breaks down, and they say, we're gonna pay for your car to get fixed. And we say, no, that's okay, thank you very much, but there was just something about it that didn't feel right. A little bit later, the TV breaks down, and you know, it's one of those TVs, back in the days we still repaired TVs when they broke and didn't throw them away. The repair bill was going to be too much, and we couldn't afford it, and so this couple says, let us pay for your TV repair bill. And again, thank you very much. No thank you. We just wouldn't feel right about that. Christmas time came up. We were in New Jersey. My parents were in Israel. Catherine's parents were in Mississippi, and we wanted to go home, but no money Christmas time. And so this couple said, look, you are some of the best friends we have ever in our lives had. You are better to us. You mean more to us than our own parents do. So let us fly you to Mississippi. Once again, it just didn't feel right. I was young, green, inexperienced, but I just knew, no, this is too much. They were overly dependent upon us. What was really happening was they were trying to buy us. I couldn't put words on it then, but they just so desperately wanted to be our good friends that no matter what it cost, they were going to do that. Then you know the car that had trouble earlier? Well, now it's now several months, many months later, and the car this time is dead. The end. There is no repairing it. And so they say to us, look, you are our best friends ever. Please, please, just let us buy you a new car. And you're thinking, give me their names. I'd like to get to know them. And I knew it wasn't right. What was happening was that they had become overly dependent. They just so desperately wanted to be friends of solid, good people, that they would do anything, including trying to buy us. And you know, there are some people out there that are so desperate for friendship that they will do anything to be your friend. And so one of the dangers, one of the perils of friendship evangelism is that your friendship becomes an end in and of itself, part one. And part two, your friends become overly dependent upon you. And at first, it's like, oh, wow, they want to be with us. That's great. But then eventually, if you've ever had one of those relationships where their friends were overly dependent, it's like they are leeches, and they want to suck a hold of you, and they won't let go. And it's like, get away from me. I can't take it. It's too much. Just too much. You've had some people like that, I suspect. So that's the peril of friendship evangelism. And number five, and finally, you tend to assume too much responsibility for results. We are preaching, we are teaching the gospel. We are the planters, we are the waterers, and we think if we plant and water, if we fertilize just right, then everybody that we befriend has got to have to respond. And yet, the fact of the matter is, and I said it just a moment ago, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, the results are not up to us. What God calls us to do is to plant and water. And we must not assume responsibility for results. Because let me tell you what, even the perfect teacher who spoke in exactly the right tone of voice, who had perfect recall of the scriptures that he needed to say at the right time, who could not only recall those scriptures, but could look right into people's hearts and minds and could use those scriptures at just the right time, his name was Jesus, even he did not convert everybody that he reached out to. You realize that, right? Jesus wasn't 100% successful in evangelism. As a matter of fact, quite to the contrary, he was so good that they ended up hating him and killing him. That's how good he was. And so, challenge number five, or pitfall or peril number five, is that we assume too much responsibility for the results. My task, your task, my brothers and sisters, is not to bring about the results. We plant the seed, we water the seed, we may even fertilize, and we get our prayer warriors on board with us praying for these lost people. But then it's up to God who gives the increase. You got it, those five? So that's the warning. Dan Cooper, before he leaves today, is saying to you, I'm all about friendship evangelism, but if you decide I'm going to invest in this, then be prepared. And there may be other perils as well, but this is five of them. It's going to take a lot of your time. You're going to be hurt, I could almost promise you. Your friendship, if you're not careful, that's all some people want, is they just want a friend and they don't want anything that makes you what you are. Some of them are even going to become overly dependent. And if you're not careful, you will assume too much responsibility for the results when the results aren't your responsibility or mine. Those are the tasks of God. And so we're like the farmer. We plant the seed, we water the seed, and then God gives the increase. We're going to sing a song in just a bit that's going to close our time tonight. But before we do that, I want to say just a little bit more about Dan and Catherine and about the Pittman Church. You have been extremely hospitable to me, to us, or not to us, to me. I told Catherine about you, so she kind of feels some of that warmth from you. And I would just like to say to you that if you're ever up in the Northeast, we'd be honored to have you come and spend a night or two. No more, but a night or two. We are 30 minutes from downtown Philadelphia. We are 2 hours from New York City, just up New Jersey Turnpike. If you've never been on a New Jersey Turnpike, that's an experience you all need to experience before you die. You do. And it may kill you, but you can be on it, yeah. So we're 2 hours from New York City, and we're 3 hours from Washington, D.C. And if you want to go into that den of iniquity, you could go to Washington, D.C. about 2 hours and 45 minutes or 3 hours, or if the traffic is bad, it may be 6 hours, but that's where we are. A lot of activity right around us, and we have just redone two of the kids' rooms upstairs, so they're actually presentable, and we would be honored to have you. So, I thank you for your hospitality, and I hope and I pray that some of the things that we've said will have stimulated, will have sparked an interest in you, and that every single one of you individually will really take this heart to heart, that I am the most effective person to reach out to my friends and my family. It's not Joe. It's not Bryce. It's not Dwight. They're good men, but they're not going to do with your friends and your relatives what you should be doing. And so my challenge is to you to pray about lost people that you know. Ask God to open doors and to give you the courage to enter through those doors at the right time. It's been a blessing. And are we going to close with a song, or how are we going to close here? A song and a prayer we're going to close with. Okay, good. Come sing for us, Bryce. Or don't sing for us, sing with us. Yeah.